You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the many interesting inventions of famed Wisconsin conservationist John Muir.
First, the media and political activists often pay attention to the big donors in presidential candidates, raising questions about the influence these donors might have on a future president.
But not as much light is usually shown on the backers of those running for vice president, even though the second-in-command will have a seat at the table for many high-level policy discussions. Libby Watson joins us now. She's a staff writer at the Sunlight Foundation. Her reporting focuses on influence and specifically on campaign finance and dark money in the 2016 election. She was involved in new reports on donors to Tim Kaine and Mike Pence. Libby, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why focus in on the running mates and the money that's been part of their political careers?
Well, it's exactly what you said. I mean, there's a reason that we look at donors to presidential candidates themselves. We're interested in who's been trying to have an influence on those candidates, possibly. And it's exactly the same for vice presidential candidates. And, you know, it also gives an indication of who they might try to raise money from. And if they've, you know, raised money from people in the past, it makes sense that they'll try to raise money from them again when they're running for vice president.
Before we get into the individual candidates themselves, let's talk about the kinds of donations. There's the obvious ones any of us might think of. Somebody gives money to their president or their campaign for governor or senate or Congress, as the case may be. But there's other kinds of money they're involved in raising as well. Can you talk about some of the different sources you were trying to figure out?
Sure. Well, it's a little different because it just so happens that, you know, Tim Kaine is from Virginia and Mike Pence is from Indiana, and they actually don't have contribution limits in those states. You know, a lot of states have, federally, there are limits on how much an individual or, a corporation, for example, can't give directly to a candidate federally. But Indiana and Virginia both have no limits on the amount you can give. So normally you would have to, you know, check for, you know, what super PACs they're involved with and so on, because, you know, donations to super PACs are unlimited. But in these cases, you know, we found instances of, wealthy individuals giving hundreds of thousands to the candidates. So, in this case, it was, you know, mostly just actually their campaign committees. But you've also, you know, when you're looking at these things, you've also got to look at dark money, you know, any 501c4s or nonprofits that these candidates have been involved with. That's always a really important thing to look at, too.
And as I understand it, these are both candidates in different capacities who have helped raise money, not just for their own campaigns, but for other candidates as well.
Right, exactly. And, you know, Tim Kaine was the head of the DNC for several years. So, you know, in that capacity would have been intimately involved with, a lot of fundraising.
Let's start breaking down what you found out about both the candidates. Let's start on the Republican side with Mike Pence, governor of Indiana, running mate now of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Tell us about his political background and some of the donations he raised.
Sure. So one of his biggest donors is actually a billionaire. Everyone's got to have a billionaire these days, I guess, if they want to run for something. And his was this fellow, Dean White, who's a sort of billionaire real estate mogul. And he's given Pence about $775,000 over time. Other people have given to him, Anthony Moravec, I think, who owns a laboratory, and Bob Perry, who is a GOP mega donor, you know, who's given to a lot of candidates. But also, actually, Pence received a significant amount of money, most of his money from the Republican Governors Association. Mother Jones pointed out that that's possibly an indication that he might have trouble raising money on the vice presidential side, because, you know, that's an indication that he had to get more money from the party rather than, you know, stumping up his own donations.
Do you see any patterns in terms of particular kinds of business and interests that have supported him in the past?
Not particularly. I mean, you know, honestly, with a lot of, these candidates, especially, you know, the higher up you get, people, these people aren't turning down money. So you tend to see, a pretty reasonably even distribution of industries, you know. I mean, a lot of industries will give, basically because a lot of industries will give to both sides. A lot of industries and companies, you know, will give to both Democrats and Republicans. Because, you know, they want to be able to pick up the phone and call whoever's in office, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. So It's a reasonably even distribution.
And when Mike Pence was selected as the running mate, some of the talk was, he's friendly with the Koch brothers and their network of donors who were not, and still, as far as I can tell, not big fans of Donald Trump. What do we see in terms of donations from either the Koch brothers to his presidential or his political past?
Yeah, so David Koch gave $300,000 to Pence's war chest, which is pretty significant. But you're right in saying that, you know, the big issue with these big donors, you know, including Koch and also Dean White, the billionaire who gave him $700,000, that's all well and good. But, you know, obviously the issue with Trump is that he's so, whatever adjective you want to use, toxic, I guess, that, you know, a lot of these donors don't want to associate with them, and well, you know, they'll find that their money is better spent elsewhere. And that's certainly been the case with, you know, Dean White, who's actually, you know, Mother Jones pointed out, has often tended to give his money down ballot rather than at the presidential level. So I wouldn't be surprised if that would continue, because a lot of big donors are doing that this year on the Republican side.
Talking to Libby Watson from the Sunlight Foundation about the political donors in the history of both the major party vice presidential candidates, Tim Kaine and Mike Pence. We've been talking about Mike Pence. Let's turn to the Democrat now, Libby. Tim Kaine, what stands out looking back at his political past?
Well, one interesting thing is that he's never lost an election. He was first elected to the Richmond, Virginia City Council in 1994 and has never lost since. So that's got to feel pretty good. But yeah, I mean, he's had some big donations. John Grisham gave his campaign $25,000, which is interesting. And yeah, he's had big donations from a lot of companies like Comcast gave $30,000. Universal Leaf Tobacco, that's obviously a big deal in Virginia, gave $30,000. So yeah, he's had some big donations from big corporations.
Oh, when you think of a big name donor on the liberal side of things, the name George Soros comes up often. And has he donated to Tim Kaine in the past?
Not as far as I know, but you know, I will say that he's obviously been involved in funding the Hillary Clinton campaign so far. So yeah, that definitely should be noted.
And Tim Kaine, as you mentioned earlier, he was a fundraiser not just for his own campaigns, but also for the Democratic National Committee. What kind of things did you find when you looked at that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's you know, clearly one of the advantages for him is that, you know, he's got these links with people he's been fundraising. You know, that one of the biggest jobs of the head of the DNC is to fundraise, and you know, he's been doing that for years. So it's definitely been noted that his ties to Wall Street are going to be helpful, that he's been able to raise money from Wall Street in the past, and presumably will continue to do that as he's running for vice president.
And he had a big, if I read the report correctly, he had a really big money race for the Senate there in a swing state in Virginia. Can you talk about the kind of financial firepower that came into that one?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because he actually that year faced the third highest amount of dark money spending against him. And so, you know, often when that happens, that's a way, you know, he'll mobilize his side, too. And so he got help from outside groups like a New Virginia PAC, the League of Conservation Voters, which has also been making pro-Hillary expenditures this election. Majority PAC spent $6 million on his race. So, yeah, that often is what happens. When one side mobilizes, then the other side has to compete.
And Libby, for people who want to track the money in this national presidential campaign and other races, what kind of resources would you recommend if they want to get out there and try to follow the money themselves?
Definitely. Our website, sunlightfoundation.com. We have a tool called Influence Explorer that allows you to sort and search donations and campaign finance reports in real time. So you can look at who's donating to super PACs. You can download the information as Excel files. Open Secrets also has a great tool for searching, you know, individual donors. You know, so you can look up if, you know, you're interested in who, you know, Dean White or David Cope has donated to. You could put their name in and find that out.
Libby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, anytime.
Libby Watson is a staff writer at the Sunlight Foundation, which released recent reports on past donors to the major party vice presidential nominees. When you think of John Muir, what comes to mind? Most likely you think of his work in conservation, maybe his nature writings, maybe even his background in agriculture, his time in Wisconsin, of course. But this was news to me. He was also a prolific inventor.
According to our next guest, Muir's portfolio of inventions ran the gamut. He made everything from practical agricultural tools to an elaborate machine designed to make his sister's doll dance on top of a block. And had it not been for a freak accident, Muir may have invented a whole lot more.
Matt Blessing joins us now. He's the state archivist at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He recently wrote about John Muir's years as an inventor for the Wisconsin Magazine of History. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So as we mentioned, a lot of people think about John Muir and don't think of inventor, and I didn't. Is this a surprise to a lot of people when they hear this?
Right. Well, we think about John Muir, I think he is part of the pantheon of great environmental thinkers, along with Henry David Thoreau and Teddy Roosevelt, Alda Leopold, Sigurd Olson, Gaylord Nelson, John Muir. Four out of the five names that I just mentioned have Wisconsin ties, but very few people know about his Wisconsin connection or about his inventions, which first brought him to fame.
And Muir got that inventing itch when he was a boy. He was growing up in Wisconsin on a farm. Can you tell us a little bit more about his early inventing days?
Sure. John Muir accompanied his father and younger brother to a farm right on the frontier in 1849. Wisconsin had become a state just a year before. The farm is located 7 miles south of present-day Montello. And this was a very remote area of the state at the time. Muir's father was a member of a Calvinist sect and kept very strict rules for both of his sons. John Muir had memorized the Old Testament by the time he was a young teenager. By memory and by sore flesh, he wrote in his memoir, The Story of My Boyhood and Youth. And he worked extremely hard, carving not just one but two farms out of the Wisconsin wilderness. By the time he's in his late teens, he starts to clash with his overbearing father. And it was all over bedtime, because as an 18 or 19-year-old, his father is insisting that his eldest son go to bed with the rest of the family after evening chores and after evening worship, which in the winter months was about 8 p.m. And as an 18 or 19-year-old, he chafes at that rule and clashes with his father, who he respected. And finally, one day, the father said, "John, you must go to bed with the rest of the family, but you can get up at any given hour you wish." And Muir quickly discovers that he can rise at about midnight or 1 a.m. And rather than disturb the rest of the family, he goes to the cellar of his father's farmhouse, and he begins tinkering and inventing wooden contraptions that would ease the labor on the farm.
Yeah, talk about some of those first contraptions, those first inventions that Muir came up with in the cellar.
Well, the first thing he does is he finds a steel corset that had belonged to his mother, that it was just something around the farmyard that had been saved. And he very methodically snips and sharpens that corset into a bandsaw. And then he builds, the first thing he builds is a portable sawmill that he's able to carry around the farm. He actually dams a little creek on the farm to power that sawmill. This is in the late 1850s. But these are all basically labor-saving devices, a water wheel, an agricultural livestock feeder. And after he makes these inventions, then he goes and creates a second round of inventions that are basically timers that automate all of these things.
And it sounds like he, along the way, gets his big break at a fair in Wisconsin. Tell us about what he showed there and why it mattered.
Well, he had a very understanding neighbor who recognized Muir's genius, and that neighbor encouraged him to pack up some of these inventions and trudge them down to the state fair of 1860, which that year was on the far west side of Madison in present day where Camp Randall is. And so his brother drove him to the little town of Partyville, 9 miles away. Muir was so isolated he had never been to the train depot at Partyville, and he rode the train down to Madison. And he was ushered into a building at the State Fair called the Temple of Arts, and he displayed two clocks and a homemade barometer. And for 3 days over the course of that weekend of the State Fair, people thronged to this backwoods inventor who had whittled these these inventions. And it's actually, there were reporters at the State Fair looking for stories. And he lands himself on the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal as this inventor from Buffalo Township in central Wisconsin.
And he did start to go out into a career in factories and bringing this invention spirit into them. Talk about the next steps for him before he ended up on this. We'll get to the injury that led him in another direction.
Well, it's really two steps. First, from Camp Randall, he looks to the north and he sees a knoll about a mile away, and that's the beginnings of the University of Wisconsin. And before he goes home, he explores the University of Wisconsin campus, and he's back 3 months later enrolled as what we would call an adult special student, because he's pushing the age of 22 as a freshman. And he takes a room on the first floor of North Hall, which is still standing, halfway up Bascom Hill, and he has these inventions in his dorm room. And adventuresome mothers would bring their young children down to North Hall to look at these inventions.
Let's talk about some of those before we go too far.
Sure.
The self-waking bed?
Yes. he had a clock that would, on the hour, remove one book and replace it with another so that he could keep up with all of his studies. And this clock was also attached to a bed that, at the given hour each morning, would lift the groggy student at a 45-degree angle. And when his feet hit the floor, another device would light an oil lamp for 3 minutes because he was conserving fuel. That would give him, he's a poor college student, and it would give him just enough lamp light to get dressed. And kids and their mothers would come and visit this room, and they would try out the wake-up bed.
Do we know if these things actually worked?
In the early 19-teens, he wrote his first autobiography, The Story of My Boyhood and Youth. And he describes one of the clocks that he had at the State Fair, saying that 50 years later, it was still working at his home in Martinez, California. Huh. And we also have evidence at the Historical Society of letters that were donated from some of his classmates at the University of Wisconsin who describe it in the first person years later.
We're talking with Matt Blessing right now from the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he recently wrote about John Muir's years as an inventor, maybe a side of him we didn't know so much about. You wrote about this for the Wisconsin Magazine of History, and you described sort of the self-waking bed and the light that went along with it. And he also, he did something nice for his sister. He wanted her doll to dance, and he set up something pretty elaborate. Can you describe that one for us?
Well, Muir was always kind to children, and he actually created this elaborate rigged system that with his youngest sister's doll that was automated and would actually dance on top of a block of wood. We don't actually have that invention. That has not survived the 150 years, but we do have an image of it that he self-illustrated for his autobiography, and that's available online. You can look at it on wisconsinhistory.org, the Historical Society's website.
Now, John Muir might be famous to us only as an inventor if he'd continued on this path, but as I mentioned, I teased a little earlier, he was working in a factory, and then something happened that made him rethink where he was going.
Right. After the Civil War, he landed a job in Indianapolis at a carriage manufacturer, and he was quickly recognized by the proprietors of that factory as a mechanical genius, and he was doing very well for himself as a self-taught engineer. He was there in 1866, 1867. He's about 28 years old, and he's at sort of a crossroads in his life. He does not know what he wants to do with his life, and one evening he was sharpening a file, and a piece of the file pierced his right cornea. The other eye then went into sympathetic shock, and for the next month or so, he lay in complete blindness with bandages over his eyes. And it was a transformational, shocking injury. And when the bandages were removed a month later, his sight had returned. And it's at that point where he decides to abandon this path where he's getting attention for these inventions and for his engineering genius. And that leads him to his life that a lot of us know about in terms of his passion for the environment and the study of botany and glaciation and so forth.
So obviously something happened. He had a change of heart, and he thought, obviously he made something of this blindness, this injury that he went through. Do you know anything about his thinking about why he then turned to conservation, what it was about the blindness that steered him away from inventing?
Well, it really goes back to his time at the University of Wisconsin and the mentors, the faculty members that he met when he was in Madison. But in particular, a faculty member's wife by the name of Jeannie Carr. And it was Jeannie Carr who introduced a very young John Muir to Ralph Waldo Emerson. And in some, reading Emerson and his writings about oneness with nature and finding spiritual truth through nature, even to the point of ecstasy. And it was that work in a 19th century factory and recovering from that industrial accident that steered him more towards the writings of the Transcendentalists, and eventually lands him in Yosemite and the Muir that most of us know.
And Matt, very briefly, we can see some of his drawings and actually some of the artifacts themselves at the Historical Society. Is that right?
Right. I mean, probably the most famous artifact that the Wisconsin Historical Society owns is in the first floor lobby of the headquarters building at the base of Bascom Hill. And it's the famous desk clock that circulated the books, has two enormous compasses as the front legs, kind of an homage to science. The back legs are made out of wooden blocks that are made to look like books, and just a fantastic artifact that I see handfuls of people each and every day marveling at this inventive genius.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Matt Blessing with the Wisconsin Historical Society. He recently wrote about John Muir's years as an inventor for the Wisconsin Magazine of History.
Coming up, we talk about police body cam footage. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Over the past few years, there have been several high-profile cases of people killed by police. There was Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, Laquan McDonald, Sandra Bland, Alton Sterling, and sadly several more. These cases have sparked both outrage and conversations about the role of the police in a community.
And just this weekend, Milwaukee was rocked by the police shooting of Sylville Smith, who police say was armed at the time of his death. However, the Milwaukee police haven't yet released body camera footage to the public, which has led to some accusations that law enforcement is not being transparent.
Cammie Chavis joins us now to talk about the role that body cam footage plays in investigations and in public perception. She's a law professor and the director of the Criminal Justice Program at the Wake Forest University Law School. She's also a former prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. Cammie, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Cammie, is there any kind of standardized approach to how police departments deal with body cam footage?
So that's a very interesting question, because there's almost nothing standard about body cameras and the policies that we're seeing. Even though it's not a brand new technology, the widespread implementation of these cameras is fairly new. And there's a patchwork, I think, of state laws, local regulations that are regulating their use. A lot of what's happening with body cameras is going to be governed by the internal regulations of the police department, just in terms of when the officers turn their footage, turn the cameras on, and the operation of that. But as far as access to the footage, there are a lot of state laws that could preclude releasing that footage.
So you've described this patchwork approach across the nation. So can you walk us through some of the different ways departments across the country have acted when it comes to releasing this footage after a police shooting?
Yes, there are many different, unfortunately, the problem of police shootings is not as uncommon, I think, as we'd like it to be. And there have been several officer-related shootings in major cities, Houston, Los Angeles, where the mayors in those cities have released the footage. They're typically, this is, I said, kind of governed by a statute or a local regulation. In Washington, D.C., the mayor there released body camera footage. There was a rule that basically gives the mayor, on a case-by-case basis, the authority to release the footage. In the matter, it has to be a matter of significant public interest, and the mayor would have to consult with the chief of police and in that city with the U.S. Attorney's Office, who prosecutes the local cases. So there's the mayor can make the decision. There has to be some consultation, and it has to be a matter of significant public interest. The problem with that is that any time you have a police-related shooting, this could be a matter of a significant public interest. So we're seeing the tension between wanting to have that the officers wear the cameras for the accountability that it provides, but then kind of what happens to that footage in the wake of a shooting. And I guess I would also say that in Los Angeles, and this is probably true in some other jurisdictions, the release of the footage, while it's not automatic, it's not completely shrouded from public view because you have kind of oversight commissions that would have access to it. So there are a variety of different approaches here.
So let's look at the shooting in Milwaukee over the weekend. The mayor of Milwaukee referenced the footage, but it has not been released to the public. And there's been a growing frustration there among some people saying they want to see this footage to help them decide how to feel about this because there was unrest in the city there. So what do you make of that decision? It's been since Saturday not to release the footage.
So there are many different reasons why a law enforcement agency or why the city might not want to release that footage. And I think that, first of all, we have, of course, the privacy concerns of, and I'm not saying that this is the case in the case of the shooting there in Milwaukee, but anytime you have this body camera footage, there can be bystanders present, other folks with privacy interests, and so to release the footage, you'd want to take some time to redact that footage and protect privacy. But in this case, it's more than likely the fact that this is now, it could become evidence in a criminal case. And there are lots of reasons that law enforcement officials would want to hold on to that information for a little while. You don't want witnesses who may need to be called to trial who've seen this footage and in some way kind of taint their perception or taint that they might have to say about it. Having said that, however, I think that the reason that so many communities and civil rights groups have called for the widespread implementation of these cameras is because of the transparency and the accountability, the potential for transparency and accountability that they can provide. So it's a really delicate balance in terms of, releasing that footage, but also, not wanting to jeopardize any criminal case. But the community certainly has legitimate concerns that, they want to know, want to see what happened.
We're talking with law professor Cami Chavis right now from Wake Forest University Law School, talking about the issues surrounding body cameras, especially in light of the shooting in Milwaukee this weekend. And this Sylville Smith case has prompted activists to call for the release of the footage from that body camera from the officer. Here's Martha De La Rosa of Wisconsin Jobs Now at a news conference. This is from this morning.
Wisconsin Jobs Now and the partners at the table are here to urge the State Department of Justice to release the Milwaukee Police Department office body cam video from the Seville Smith killing to his family first, if they have not done so yet, and then to the community. We in no way want to complicate the DOJ investigation, but it's imperative that this is transparency with the family and the community for this case. Without transparency and the release of the body cam video, this community cannot, I repeat, this community cannot fully work to heal and move forward in a positive way.
And Cammie, what do you make of her statement there that the community is not going to be able to move forward without that body cam footage? And the case was made this morning that, in fact, there's some people are worried about bigger, greater unrest without this footage being released.
Yes, I think that, I also heard Ms. De La Rosa say that, you know, that the family should be able to view this footage. And I agree with that, although, you know, it doesn't have to, even if it's not going to be released publicly, I think certainly the family or family attorneys should be able to view that, because then those other concerns that I mentioned in terms of preserving evidence and not wanting to taint a witness pool, that just wouldn't apply to the family, and it could only serve to give greater transparency for them. So I agree with that statement. I also though want to say that, you know, there the unrest and my heart goes out to the Milwaukee community. I've spent some time there recently, actually, and I know the great frustration that exists in the city, but I also know all of the wonderful people there who are doing very good work in terms of trying to improve police and community relations. But sometimes there are greater concerns, I think. We can't always kind of bow to the political pressure to have things released. But I think when we're talking about police accountability and transparency, and we know that it's the lack of accountability or the lack of transparency that breeds distrust, that's a very powerful statement. And I think that once the appropriate authorities have had the opportunity to review that footage and make sure that they've spoken to witnesses and taken the necessary statements, I don't think that there should be a lengthy time before this video is released.
And can we just briefly, before we can get some callers in, you mentioned issues of trust. I mean, do you think there are people who have talked about being concerned about issues of tampering because it's been a while? How seriously do you take that concern that this is video that could be somehow tampered with?
Well, I think it is a concern that we need to understand that concern is out there, and that concern comes from a long history of not being able, or of having a distrust of law enforcement, particularly in some communities of color. I think that if we this reminds me of the Laquan McDonald shooting, where and we know that now 7 officers have been fired in Chicago because the tape wasn't released, and these officers made statements that would seem to exonerate or make that shooting seem justified. And then you have this long waiting period, and then when the tape is finally released, those 7 officers perjured themselves. So I want to be very careful and have folks understand that there's a large percentage, the vast majority of police officers are doing their jobs in a professional manner. But like any other profession, like any other population, there are going to be those bad apples. And when you see that in Chicago, 7 officers perjured themselves, gave statements that were inconsistent with what happened on that tape. That's very real, and it cannot be ignored. And so I think there, you know, the length of time, I think it was almost a year or something like that, before that footage in the Laquan McDonald case was released. Those officers.
Cami Chavis is with us to talk about how and when body camera footage should be released following a police shooting. She's a law professor and director of the Criminal Justice Program at the Wake Forest University Law School.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Why do you think body cam footage in these cases should or should not be released? How should the videos be released to the public? And in this case from this weekend in Milwaukee, do you think those videos, that video cam footage, should be released? And if so, when? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can comment on the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org.
We're continuing our conversation about the role body cam footage plays in investigations into police shootings and when and how it should be released to the public. This in light of the shooting in Milwaukee, the police shooting over the weekend, and some growing frustration among some groups of people about the lack of release of that footage. And we're joined now by Cami Chavis. She's a law professor and director of the Criminal Justice Program at the Wake Forest University Law School.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the video of the shooting, the police body cam video of the shooting this weekend, should be released? Should it be released now? Should it have been released by now? Or is this something that should never be released or should wait until the state's Department of Justice investigation is done? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you have more general thoughts about how, when these body cameras should be used and how the data on them, the footage on them, should be accessible to the media, to the public? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Todd with us in Sparta. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
What is your take?
My concern is that I understand where people want transparency, but my concern would be that would the actual footage, unedited footage, cause more trauma for the family? And now if we have to edit the footage to let the family see it without causing more trauma, now we've gotten away from the transparency. So I think we have to be careful as to what we're asking for here in cases like this.
Todd, thanks for the call. And Cami, I think editing is something that's outside the question most of the time. What do you say to Todd?
I agree with that. There's a tension here, and this has been a tension that we've seen as many states, localities try to, and police departments try to shore up their policies, is trying to balance that privacy with transparency.
What about the trauma aspect of it?
I think that you know, it would be up to the family. I could see if it were if it were me not wanting to see my son's last moments in that way. But at the same time, a family attorney or someone else wanting to tell me exactly how it happened or how it transpired. And so I think that those concerns can be addressed.
Todd, thanks for the call. We go next to Philip in Waukesha. Philip, hi.
Hi. Thank you guys for taking my call. Really glad this is a topic of interest. How are you doing?
Thank you.
So I'm a sociology student attending a small school in Iowa, and I've taken several courses at this point in my education on deviance and social control. And one of the things that we talk about in such courses is the nature of law enforcement and why we need police and why to function as a society we need we need cops to help regulate our behavior sometimes. And I think that maybe it would behoove the powers that be to understand that to populations in this country that do not have a historically positive relationship with law enforcement entities, that no matter which way you cut it, not releasing body cam footage, especially in circumstances such as this, it seems to me to be a very good way to simply further erode an already very weak relationship.
All right. Thank you, Philip, for that perspective. And what do you say to Philip's concern there about this weakening troubled relationships?
Once again, I agree with the caller. We have seen, and there are numerous studies showing that communities of color, thinking about African Americans and Latinos, have vastly different views about police officers and the treatment that they receive from police officers in this country. We also know there are lots of statistics that suggest that police officers are more likely to use force against folks of color, and there's a recent study that says that police officers are that blacks disproportionately are killed, are twice as likely to be killed by police officers. So I think when we're talking about trust and building relationships, we cannot do it without understanding that context.
We're talking with law professor Cami Chavis right now from Wake Forest University Law School, talking about the issue surrounding body camera use in police forces. And we'll go next to Dan in Independence. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yeah, my question is that if they release this video and they find he was not justified, and then they decide to have a trial, well, now they've released the video, where did they get the jury pool from? Because everyone thinks he's guilty.
Dan, thank you. And Dan raising questions of tainting the jury pool. Cami, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that is certainly when we're talking about the concerns about preserving evidence for, a criminal proceeding. And it might not just be a criminal proceeding. There are other administrative proceedings as well that take place. And so that can be a concern when we're thinking about not releasing the footage. However, it's interesting. We've seen by now, unfortunately, over the past few years with not only body camera footage, but footage from amateur, cell phone footage. We've seen a number of these officer-related shootings captured on video. And no matter how bad it may look to a layperson, it's, sometimes the jury or judges find that it was justified or prosecutors decline to prosecute. So I think that there's a dual concern. One concern is, okay, what transparency? What happened so we, the public, can see what happened? But then the other concern is, all right, now in a court of law, we have to see whether or not what happened rises to the level of excessive force.
And can we
or an unjustified.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but is there any concern here with the more widespread use of body cameras that we're becoming too reliant on this body cam footage? And it could be flawed, I guess, depending on the perspective, the angle of the camera shot, all of that.
Certainly, that's a concern. Should be different perspectives, but besides that, I think the body cameras are not a panacea for police reform. There are lots of other things that police departments can and should do, beginning with training, de-escalation, procedural justice training for their officers, diversity in hiring. There are a lot of things that police departments can do to build this trust and to increase accountability.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Cami.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Cami Chavis, a law professor and the director of the Criminal Justice Program at the Wake Forest University Law School. And she was with us there to talk about how and when body cam footage should be released to the public following a police shooting. You can weigh in. Let us know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page.